You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
All the girls are complicated. Everyone is precious too, and you might get lucky if you do. Oh, you might get lucky if you do. Find the one that makes you laugh. Find the one that takes your breath, where you won't get everything that you want. Oh, but you'll need one to dote upon.
Hello, and welcome to the Christian Feminist Podcast. I'm Sarah Klooster. Today, we are discussing the HBO Max series, The Last of Us, which premiered to universal acclaim in 2023. We will specifically discussing the first episode, but we'll be making references throughout the series and video game. The original video game was released in 2013 by Sony and was also received universal acclaim. The series and video game follow protagonist Joel, who is escorting young teen Ellie across America in a fairly epic road trip. They have to deal with infected and the humans who are trying to survive as they try to get Ellie to safety where she can possibly help find a cure and help end the zombie hordes for good. Pedro Pascal shines in his second role as a gruff lone warrior escorting a child across a great distance. And Bella Ramsey, formerly of Game of Thrones, as I guess also is Pedro Pascal, has mysterious immunity to the fungus infecting all of the other zombies. Joining us today in our fight against the zombie hordes are Laura and Christina. Ladies, it's been a while. Please introduce yourself. Laurie, why don't you go first?
Hi, everyone. Thanks, Sarah. I'm Laurie Norris. I'm down in Athens at the University of Georgia, keeping things as stable as possible. I'm sorry. I got distracted by thinking about the last time that the three of us sat down to talk and had anything in my life changed. And the only real difference is I have a cat now and Lando is the cutest thing in the world.
I love your cat.
Isn't she so sweet? She's so salty and spicy too. I love her.
Just like her owner.
Yes. Well, you are keeping the zombie hordes from attacking the University of Georgia, right? That's your main job.
It's like my vocation, not my profession. Okay. It's a calling.
It's a calling to protect from zombies. I understand that. There are a lot of zombies in higher ed, and I should know because I have been 25 years teaching at Wheaton College, and I am retiring at the end of the year.
That is very true.
So. This is the first time it's been announced it publicly on a radio. So,
oh well, congratulations, Christina, on your happy retirement.
I am happy and happy to be moving to Texas. So,
the HEB, I'm telling you, I'm going to go up and show you, and we're going to go to HEB together. It's one of our grocery stores, and it is just.
Oh, I know HEB. You definitely know about that. Let me tell you off the air some story about it later. But yes,
all right.
I know that grocery store.
I mean, right. I even know HEB's wonders.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah. Wonderful place.
It's a wonderful place. All right. HEB, if you would like to sponsor us, please give us a call. All right. So, dear listeners, this is an episode with two very distinctive parts. Technically, it takes place in three parts. So, we have an initial outbreak to use our zombie kind of movie lingo. And then we have a 20-year jump, which then shows kind of what's happened to society since. Laurie, why don't you give us a little bit of a summary of what happens in the first part of this episode, and then we can discuss.
Okay, so in the olden times part of the episode, there is a cold open that is apparently not a part of the game. Keeping with tradition, I am here for the TV, not for the pew pew gameplay, because my hands don't do those things real good. And in the cold open, we have what is like a Dick Cavett style late night talk show where Josh Brenner plays the host, interviews Christopher Heyerdahl as a doctor and the wonderful John Hannah as another doctor. And they're talking about threats to the world And Heyerdahl's character is talking about how viruses are horrible and viruses. And, you know, this is coming out in the middle of COVID. So, and then Brenner's character turns to John Hannah and says, "Hey, are you afraid of viruses?" And he's like, "Nope. We're going to kick viruses every time. That's a war we can win." "What are you afraid?" "Fungus." And everyone laughs. And then, you know, he talks about how fungus are going to, it could destroy the world. But hey, it's safe because they can't live in hot bodies. And the world's too cool for that, literally. What's going to happen in 1968 looking into the future? Is the world going to get warmer? And then everyone in the audience goes, "Ooh." And it flashes forward to what we find out is 2003. And we follow a young girl. She looks like she's maybe 13, 14 years old. And her name's Sarah. And she gets up and wakes up in Austin, Texas, because this is the HEB sponsored episode, and it turns out that it's also her dad Joel's birthday. So we see them just having their regular, hurry off to get to work, hurry off to get to school. Joel is waiting on his brother to arrive so they can go to their construction job. And Ellie's gonna make pancakes for Joel's birthday, but he forgot to get pancake mix, so she makes eggs instead. And
thank goodness, this is the best recommendation for the keto diet of any TV show I've ever seen.
Yeah, and you notice Tommy, when he arrives, he bemoans the lack of pancakes and proceeds to eat leftover chicken wings. So it's just all protein all the time. And so this part
Atkins,
of the
episode, Atkins.
Right? Atkins, brought to you by HEB and Atkins. The episode goes on, the day in the life, and in the background there are some just weird, that's odd, radio saying something's going crazy in Indonesia, in Jakarta, and then, you know, the characters have a conversation about where is Jakarta, and the daughter goes, "The doy, it's the capital of Indonesia." And then we see her in school, and there's the camera pans up across the classroom, and this is how we know what year it is, what era it is, because there's a picture in this public school room of the president, and it's George W. Bush. So that gives us a sense of time immediately. And also, I think, like, a sense of oof, because, you know, some ominous things happened during his tenure. And then we have Ellie going to get her dad's watch fixed. It's the birthday present she's doing for him. So she goes downtown from her suburban home and goes downtown to a watch repair shop, which I love the idea that there's a watch repair shop in a neighborhood. That's great.
We still have those. But also, the other thing that we know, the most fantastical part about this, is that even in 2003, that there's no traffic in downtown Austin. She just gets there, no problem, gets back. Nobody is on I-35 today.
Yeah, you just pop on a bus and be where you need to be when you thought you were going to be there. So this is not in our reality. It's in a branching reality. But while Sarah is getting the watch fixed, the weirdnesses that have been going on in the background sort of come to a head, and the wife of the repair guy closes up the shop and shoos her home out and tells her to go home. Sarah goes home because the buses are still running, and despite all of the cops on the road, everything seems to be just normal. And when she gets home, she goes to the neighbor's house because, you know, neighborliness, and she hangs out with the elderly couple, and one of the elderly people's even more elderly mom. I don't know the nature of those relationships, and it's normal, but we start to see some, like, oh, that's weird. The dog is staring at the super old lady now. Why is the dog being weird?
You always need That's the first rule of movies. Pay attention to what the dog is doing.
Yeah, the dog's
don't
always
kill
right.
The dog. That's the second rule of movies. Don't kill somebody's dog.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I would put don't kill the dog first.
Yes.
But, yeah. But, you know, let's split hairs later. I have to move faster. So Ellie goes back home and waits for her dad, who was supposed to show up at a certain time. He gets home late because of dad stuff. And we get the sense that Joel is, not only do we realize that he is a single father, but he's kind of put upon, and he's not really paying too much attention to the world around him. Probably because of like stress, but it also seems to be just his personality he's focused on him and he's focused on his, and he gets wrapped up in that. Sarah is a little bit more of a precocious teenager, so she's connected more with her community and paying attention, but she's also a child and not really sure what's going on. So when they sit down to watch a DVD action movie together, she falls asleep in his lap because it's real late. And while he's enjoying that, you know, dad moment, I can finally relax. It's my birthday. Here's my favorite girl. We're sleeping. This is great. He gets a phone call from his brother, Tommy, calling him to bail him out of jail because Tommy got arrested for fighting in a bar. And we hear Tommy say, but that guy was just acting real weird. And then we have cut to later when Sarah wakes up. Joel's not home. She's a little confused. That's when the world really starts ending. And we're following Sarah. And then she's confused. And the neighbors there's dead stuff. And what's going on all over the place? And Joel and Tommy zoom up in the truck, and Joel yells, get in the truck. And then the old lady comes out. She was in a wheelchair. Now she's running all over the place, eating people. And Sarah watches her dad kill the old lady, braining her with a really heavy wrench. And then they get in the truck and they drive away in all of the confusion, no one knowing what's going on, and becomes a massive chase scene, which is very clearly directly lifted from the video game. Not ever having played the video game, even I knew this had to be like the recreation of
that. I thought so too. Yeah, it so much did look like that to me too.
Yeah, so cut. I'm going to cut some more out. The most important thing that happens is after the big, this is clearly a video game, there's a plane crash and, you know, the military on a highway and stuff. Joel is trying to get Sarah, whose foot is hurt, to safety, and is confronted by a rather faceless soldier from the military. And he's, we're not infected. And the soldier gets on the phone, on his radio, to talk to his commanding officer, and all we hear is, yeah, yeah, yes. And then you know that the soldier is going to kill them both, and gunfire happens, and Sarah dies this really ugly, brutal death in Joel's arms, and we cut to black. And then we go 20 years in the future.
All right. Well, before we go into some of the stuff for in the future, there are a couple of things I think we might want to talk about initially for just that first part. And one of them is, I think you had brought up, Laurie, is that soldier who's just like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to shoot. I'll just shoot them. That's fine. You know, every time there's like a disaster movie, not a disaster movie, but in zombie movies, it kind of is this trope that like the American military kind of just overnight were like, no, wait, they're just kind of the Gestapo, actually.
Yes, right. Given the chance, they'll become the Gestapo.
And, you know, I don't know if that's just kind of a trope that they're doing, or if they're trying to say something serious about that. Because the other thing is that we don't think about sometimes is that, yeah, like the American military is very big. there are so many more civilians. And so the idea that like the actual American military could actually like, no, we're going to like they could probably get some of the big towns. Right. But like there are no bases near where I live. And so right, I think right. And so you kind of always have this thing of like, well, the American military is going to come in and they're going to like impose, they're trying to impose order, but it's also like, it's very foolish order. Like, what is it that they're trying to achieve with this? And I think it's, you know, I always think that that's kind of funny because you see that a lot and you see it in another episode later on as well of kind of the military just kind of immediately, instead of being like, yeah, so-and-so, my uncle who's in the reserves is like nameless, faceless Gestapo man. Because I know you had pointed that out in some of our notes, Lori. What are your thoughts about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a... So I think one of the things that Neil Druckmann and Craig Mazin, the producers, Druckmann was created the video game, and Mazin is the executive producer of the TV show, the showrunner for it. One of the things I think they're trying to do is make sort of an understandable connective tissue from how we get from the world that everyone who plays the game in real life or sits down to watch the TV show in real life would understand to a world that's utterly different in so many ways. And one of those forms of connective tissue, I realized I made a metaphor there that I'm not grammatically sure how to incorporate, is our expectation of what authority will do. And there is that expectation of, oh yeah, goon squads. Yeah, we understand that. We've been trained to expect goon squads. And from a structural standpoint on the video game side, yeah, you need a faceless fascist authority to fight against, because if you're going to be like, you know, shooting and stabbing things, the average person, it needs at least some sort of justification for like, oh, that's why they're the bad guy. They're the goon squad. And you need the military to have no compassion in a way in order to make the mechanism of the game work. And it drives me crazy because it feels kind of lazy, especially with the really deep characterization that most everyone else gets. And it's not until very late in this first season of the show that we even get a sense of what FEDRA, the federal version of government after the Cordyceps apocalypse happens. We don't really get to see inside FEDRA. We get to see inside the rebellion, the Fireflies, and how kind of ineffective they are in a lot of ways, but we get to see some really beautiful moments of like people who are just living through things, Murray Bartlett and Nick Offerman so there's something I think that the show missed an opportunity to complicate our relationship with the military and with FEDRA, but I understand, like, they needed...
It's like a foil.
Yeah, they just needed to put the pieces on the playing board, and to be efficient with that, they went with everybody expects the goon squad. And that's one thing I want to praise the show for, is the economy of show, don't tell. Like, that image of W... In the classroom, not only does it immediately place us in time, because it, fashion-wise, Sarah did not look like she was on TRL, so we couldn't have told from her clothes that it was 2003. And Joel, being a 36-year-old single father, is never going to be like tied to the, you know, a la mode trends that would set him out. So visually, we needed some sort of marker. So we got that. But also the slow pan across W's face, where we are now reminded of 9/11 and like the weight of what happened at the beginning of his presidency. in how that haunts, how it haunts reality even now. And then we see Sarah ask, is it terrorists? And we later discovered that it's not terrorists. It's something very different, but it sets up our paranoia. Our paranoia is established by that the simplicity of just showing that one picture. And I think I've lost the track. What was your original question?
No, she wants to know what, you know, what we liked about it. And I would like to say that I liked the, to me, one of the ways that you test a series, especially one that's based on video game, right? You're like, oh, this is going to suck. It's like, do you have an opening that is kind of misleading? I mean, okay, 1968's the opening, but after that, you meet Sarah, right? And every novelist will tell you that the first character that you introduce to the audience is the one that everyone follows and loves, right? And they made her very likable, right? Precocious and loving and, you know, and then they kill her off. So you're like, oh, okay, this is a serious, you know, serious show. We don't even get to know.
There's a very Game of Thrones thing to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to say, like, if Game of Thrones is, like, I feel like the current parlance of, like, no, you make the audience love it and then you make them hate you.
Yes.
It was very much that. And one of the things I enjoyed about the show, I think also is that it feels like it places it in time a little bit. Is that I think, Laura, you had mentioned that there's kind of this slow build of Sarah noticing this weirdness throughout the episode. And then I think that's like, you can only really pull that off in 2003, because if this were happening right now, I would just, you know, when this episode is done, I would check Twitter and it would be like hashtag zombie apocalypse.
Yeah,
correct.
And
yeah.
Like, oh no, there's a zombie apocalypse happening. And I just kind of would immediately know.
Yeah, it's so
and
true.
And so you have some 24-hour news channels, but not everyone's watching them. You don't have the social media.
Right.
So you genuinely, and also what that means is you can't have prep for it, because maybe Jakarta or, you know, maybe India or Mexico City or any other place where it may have happened, we're not seeing it. So it actually feels like it catches us much more unawares, because we can't see this, like, oh yes, for months they've been having this issue in Jakarta, and then suddenly, you know, you would just, you know, you can't have that kind of slow build in an instant communications focused world, because obviously, like, it would just be everywhere immediately, because it would be on, or it would be on TikTok and all of the various other things I'm too old to know about.
Yeah, totally. It's the Buffy the Vampire cell phone problem. Like, Waden was asked how they got around the problem of, like, never know, you know, like, where is Buffy? I don't know. Where is Buffy? We'll call her. No one has cell phones. They just have to hand wave it away. Otherwise, you don't have tension. So I think that is pretty spot on. It's like, you have to set it at a certain time where you no longer have access to the things would just remove hours worth of your show. Like, well, it's, like, it's everything.
Yeah. And I think we don't even, like, and they don't even seem to have cell phones. I rewatched the first episode. I haven't rewatched the whole series for this. I don't even feel like, it doesn't even feel like they really use cell phones that much later on in the series, does it?
No, there is no cellular network. They have a radio network, like ham radio, that they use. And
yeah,
it is,
which is explained by the apocalypse, right? Like, all the stuff would just, develop the same way.
And what you have in this is the same thing that you have in any zombie movie, which is nobody, there are no zombie movies in this world. Right. Nobody can be like, this is like Night of the Living Dead. Like, there's no vocabulary for it. And so we end up calling it, and this will probably be, unless there's anything else that we want to talk with about the first half specifically, this will be a jump that I can do for the second half, is the infected, right? We call them the infected, as opposed to zombies, or like, they didn't, and we think about Night of the Living Dead as the first zombie movie. He doesn't even call them zombies in that. They're just called ghouls, right?
Same with Walking Dead. Yeah.
Yeah, they're the walkers or the dead. Mm-hmm. We always have something other than zombies to call them, except in the ones that are like super camp, where they're being super referential. But
right.
Okay, so once we
I have one thing about the beginning. that I want to put in your brains before we move on. And so this is something that I noticed rewatching the pilot. So just like the George Bush picture, Tommy has on his truck, and you scan down real quickly to see his Desert Storm vet,
the bumper sticker.
Yeah, I saw that.
It explains so much about like what Tommy does, like how he behaves. You know, why is he able to use that assault rifle so easily? Like, why is he able to do this switch thinking about, okay, now I have to go north. He knows which way north is. I don't know which way north is, and I'm looking at the sun. And we see that, and it shows us about Tommy, and not only explains like Tommy and stuff that later on in the series, but it also explains a lot about Joel, because Joel introduces the idea of having a brother with, oh, Tommy, I got to take care of him. Tommy's clearly like capable and independent, but Joel doesn't see that. Joel only sees what he expects to be there. He misreads his brother. He misreads his daughter a lot. So he's seeing what he expects rather than what is. And he can't handle when reality comes crashing in around him. And I think that contributes a lot to why he can't process Sarah's death until Ellie. So that I got all that from a bumper sticker.
No, I think you're good for that. I think that's probably a really good point. Okay, so dear jump forward 20 years to 2023, which is the year that it's actually that the series is released. This is now probably about halfway through the episode. This is one of those like mini prestige dramas. The first episode is like the length of a full movie, right? So this is like an hour and 20 minute first episode. And so the second half of the episode falls that we are now in the post-apocalyptic future. And it opens up with a small girl walking towards what we basically learn is the Boston, you know, the Boston colony, we'll just call it, because I can't even remember the exact word they use, but the safe area of Boston. She comes in, they stick a little thing in her neck to see, is she infected? And this little girl is infected, but the soldier who's talking with her is very sweet to her. He's like, hey, we're going to get you some food. We're going to get you some toys. And they kill the little girl because she is infected and there is no cure. And then we cut to Joel, even more hardened now than he was 20 years before, basically doing the job of just throwing corpses into a pyre. I guess it's not really a pyre. I feel like that there's more symbolism if we say pyre. Just a fire. They're burning the bodies, right? And also at this point, I'm like, how many people are still dying that we have like 50 fresh corpses a day?
These cordyceps, they're tough. They are like all over you. I'm drinking hot chocolate made of cordyceps right now, being my Four Sigmatic, who is not a sponsor of our program, but so sorry about that.
Good. And then we see Joel. We also see Joel's, I'll just say, you know, paramour, partner. When people get old, to a certain age, I really hate saying girlfriend. We see Joel's romantic partner, who is, and y'all, I completely forgot her name, Tess. There we go. And she's basically being beaten up because somebody else double crossed him. And he's like, I can't let you go because I double crossed you and you're too dangerous. And my thought is like, well, then why did you double cross them? Because they are trying to get out west because Joel, Joel's younger brother, has skipped town and we don't know where he is. They haven't been able to hear from him. And so Joel is worried. That's what Joel does. When he's worried, he goes and Joel rescues people. And so they're trying to get a car battery to get out of town. And we find out pretty early on that Joel and Tess are not good people. We know this one because they keep talking about it amongst themselves and other people talk to them about like, yeah, you're not a great person. And they tell Ellie that. We meet Ellie, who is our 14, 12, she's in that age where she doesn't actually look like she's really hit puberty yet, right? that she's like right before you hit that. And she is being kept in a locked room and has apparently been kept there for several days. We find snuck out and we find more about that sneak out later on in the season. But she was bitten, came back, and everyone else who has ever been bitten has basically doesn't last 24 hours from the bite to full-blown infection. It's been almost a week for her, and if not more, and it just scabs over. Leading the leader of the Fireflies in Boston, Marlene, to say, we think that she can have it. We think that she can be cured, or we think that she can be the cure. And so what we find is while Joel and Tess are trying to skip out to go and find someone to get their money and get the this car battery, different plots align that now Joel and Tess are taking Ellie to the other Fireflies so they can take Ellie across country. As they're sneaking out, they run into a soldier who Joel had been talking with earlier, and the soldier basically said, like, no, I told you not to do this. Come on, man. You're going to make me arrest you. And he does the requisite test to see, like, are you infected? He sees the little, you know, gadget that says Ellie's infected, but Joel doesn't necessarily see this. Joel sees a soldier pointing a gun at a pre-teenage girl and just not just kills, but brutally attacks this guy. And then Tess realizes, oh, she is infected. And then it cuts out. And there's a second episode where we find out that Ellie explains, I'm not really sick. And they come to believe her and they escort her. And that begins the long journey across the country to, I guess, Colorado. I think they're going to Colorado. But that's our summary of our second
Maybe
half.
Wyoming.
Yeah, it's somewhere, I guess, with a decent hospital that they eventually have to get to.
Tommy's in Wyoming, but the hospital that they're taking Ellie to is in Colorado.
Colorado, that's right.
And so that's our second half. And I think one of the things that I appreciate about the show, I was thinking, is that especially in the second half, this is a show that, like any great show, that has a suspension of disbelief, right? That, like, if you can buy into it, then you can just really enjoy the show. It commits to the bit. It commits that this is a post-apocalyptic world. There's nobody. The woman who plays Tess is an incredibly attractive woman in real life.
Right.
But they keep her hair musty. They keep it tangled. They keep dirt all over her face. She's wearing a baggy, oversized button down. She's wearing oversized ripped jeans. And so you can't really tell. There's no moment where someone comes out sparkly clean in their, like, Tomb Raider outfit to be like, let's go on an adventure, guys. You know, like, it commits that this is a post-apocalyptic world where there's not makeup. And there's probably not any, we're probably lucky to get dial soap. And to me, that really helps suspend that disbelief that, okay, I'm going along with this. And we don't have a fan service, I guess, that you can get in other episodes, unless you just count Pedro Pascal's inherently handsome face. But what do y'all think about kind of this commitment to the bit that they have for at least the second half of the episode, or if not the whole episode?
Yeah, I think it's exactly what you say. It definitely helps you to just go along with the, you know, I mean, one of the things I really hate about American television is just how, like, anytime there's a female character and she's like a cop, she's got to look like gorgeous. And you're like, really? And wear a low cut or whatever, you know, it's like, no, this is the way it would be if something like this happened. So from a feminist perspective, I think that's nice, you know?
Yeah. I also think they probably had an entire makeup crew working overtime to make Anna Torv unattractive and still Correct. Failed, like, with the giant swollen eye and everything. Like, no, Anna Torv is beautiful. Anna Torv is always beautiful.
That bone structure will not be silenced.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But that's kind of what Bella Ramsey being a good choice too, right? Because Bella Ramsey, is not conventionally attractive, right? And a better choice as a result. More believable, very likable characters.
Yeah, the way that their face is, as so I say, I'm this is going to sound really weird, but like their face is still not done cooking in some ways, you know, that way.
Oh, that totally
little
makes
kids,
sense. Yes, very
yeah.
adolescent.
Oh, yeah. Bella's face has the face that when awkward girls like, I don't look good at this. And you're like, look, just wait till you're 22. I promise it's going to even out.
That's right. Right.
Yeah.
And that's why they were so good in Game of Thrones, right? Like, I mean, my favorite character in Game of Thrones.
Yeah. Lady
Mormont.
Yeah, the Lady of Bear Island. That's right.
Mormont. Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I really love that the world building in the show too, like the little touches that they do, that it's part of that economy of production. Like, it's all of those wires. Once you're inside the Fedra quarantine zone in Boston, like, the thousands of wires you just see strung from building to building, because there's no electricity, there's no centralized anything anymore. And so how do these work? Well, somebody climbed to the roof of a building and tied one wire to another and then precariously got it. It is the grubbiest of worlds, which makes when you go to other places, other locations, even more impactful. And that's something that you don't see really in the pilot episode, but that I appreciate about the series, and I assume is in the video games, is there's kind of this implication that the apocalypse that you expect is not the only way this could play out.
And yeah, I totally agree. I loved that about this series.
It's
fantastic.
For me, there's almost a resonance with the what John Hannah's character at the in the cold open says about this fungus, is that they will adapt and if they have to. And so you kind of see, like, Fedra is the embodiment of what happens when you refuse to adapt to things. It's like Fedra is clinging to the institutions and the authorities and the power that was present before the end of the world.
Power would be distributed.
Yeah, and then we see pockets of potentiality, or even worse. So like Kansas City, when we go there, that is an entirely different sort of living hell. Because the fascism has been taken to an extreme and then embraced by like the populace for almost justifiable reasons, but not really. And then you see, like, in Wyoming, where Tommy is, people are making a go of it, but they had to adapt and follow a completely different set of rules and norms than worked in our world in 2003. And it's the people who don't change that gets stuck and have problems. And I think that's why Joel is such a fascinating protagonist, is because we see him for essentially 20 years refusing to adapt, trapped in his pain. And like, there are moments where Tess is like hugging on him when she gets into bed after, you know, being beat up in the middle of the night. And he doesn't really move or respond. And so that tells you immediately, oh, their relationship is okay. That's fraught. And she goes with the flow, and she can go between people in a way that he can. He's just this hulk because he refuses to change. And then you get Ellie into his life and he's forced to, and it's kind of amazing. So we are the cordyceps all along.
Well, and one thing on that, you know, everyone has to adapt. There's my favorite part, like my favorite joke of the whole series, is when they're in Wyoming and they stumble across the cabin for that is the Native American indigenous couples.
Oh,
and they're
yeah.
like, how long have y'all been out here? And he's been like, we've always been here. We've always lived in rural Wyoming.
Yes, that was funny.
I've always lived off the land.
That's Graham Greene, isn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Love him.
So.
Well, yeah, there's I think, so a thing about, like, what zombies mean, right, is, and so, Sarah, you've introduced in our notes, in our conference, like, zombies mean things. So I want to talk about what these zombies mean.
Yeah. Okay, well, and so in, dear listeners, in a good zombie movie, not in all zombie movies, but in good zombie movies, the zombies in general are pretty representative of something. So in 28 Days, the zombies represent aggression. Like, they actually call it, you know, and again, they don't call them zombies there, but they call it, it's like, it's a rage sickness that you just go crazy and bite people and then they die. Like, you know, so you have rage sickness. In Dawn of the Dead, which is the second Romero movie, the zombies represent mindless consumerism, right? Because they're just drawn to the mall, right? And Shaun of the Dead, which is also a great zombie movie, the zombies are like Shaun, that they basically represent this kind of listless apathy and laziness. And so do y'all feel that the infected in this movie are representative of something greater? What do we think that could be?
Okay, I have some very strong opinions, I think, on this. So I'm going to let Christina go. If there's anything, before I run roughshod over everyone, I'm going to give her an opportunity.
Lori, I love it when you run roughshod because you're just so brilliant and I love listening to you. Just want to point that out. Okay. So I have always thought of zombies as representative of the thing that we cannot control what we think we can control. So I always think of them as like, you know, it's like Hartmut Rosa is the sociologist who wrote The Uncontrollability of the World, that the late moderns were all about trying to control things, and zombies represent that. That was always an illusion, you know, like we are never going to fully control things. And so they represent, in a sense, you know, death coming for you. No matter what, and the illusion of control never worked out. And then it's just an opportunity to show what you really need to live, rather than all the simulacra that we live in, and get you back down to brass tacks. And that's why I like zombie shows, because they do that.
Okay. That's awesome. Thank you. And also not contraindicative of what I'm about to spew on you guys. All right, brace yourselves, listeners, because I'm going on a bit of a rant. So these zombies
represent thoughts.
Yeah, I got thoughts. These zombies are totally capitalism, right? I'm putting on my tinfoil hat. Okay, so bear with me. I have, every time I watch this show, and I've watched it a lot because I actually really enjoy it, and I think if I could make my hands do the things that you're supposed to do with a controller, I'd probably enjoy playing the game. But I keep coming back to the thing connecting the zombies and the culture and everything is how insidious late industrial capitalism is, and the problems that not just as an economic system, but as a worldview creates. The way that turning people into capital, turning everything into profit motive, separates us from what is most important in our lives, and not just in big metaphorical pictures like in community and divorcing us from ourselves, but literally separating us from our food chain. You go to the grocery store and everything's wrapped in plastic. Where does food come from? It comes from plastic. But no, really, food comes from across the world, because we're sending strawberries in January from Chile. And, oh, our cereal grains come from this continent. And our protein comes from this continent. And no one has a connection to it. And so if something goes wrong somewhere in our global supply chain, we all get screwed. And it ultimately comes down to somebody is trying to take advantage of someone else so that they can prosper, so that they can profit. Everything important is left up to the cheapest bidder because everybody wants to make money off of someone else. And what we're left with...
Yeah, you know what? You're right.
Yeah, we're left with serial killers.
Yeah.
Because, sorry,
By way of cereal.
Right? That not only
that
do I love the movie
joke.
Hackers, right?
I know, it's terrible, sorry.
It's great. Serial killers. Like, I've got Matthew Lillard's Hackers character in the back of my mind saying these names out loud. But, like, the conversation that Joel and Tommy have about where is Jakarta, like, yeah, we're so divorced from our supply chains of where our food comes from because of late industrial capitalism that we're not prepared for it to be the, like, to have
negative
death inside our pantries.
That's right. And you know what? Can I just make one quick point? Like,
of course.
Cordyceps, that's the way that they work. They're a parasitic fungus. They inhabit like insects and like eat them up on the inside, leave them alive long enough, then burst out of them. So I think your thesis is right. It's a parasitic economic system.
Oh, I'm stealing that. I'm totally stealing that phrase because I
go for it.
Go on anti-capitalist rants a lot in my regular
life.
Well,
the other thing that I think that also makes it feel so interesting is that, like, you know, maybe if you were in India and you're, okay, it's coming from Indonesia, but, like, we think of ourselves as America, the breadbasket of the world, that we have, you know, amber waves of grain. So why should anything be coming from somewhere else, especially wheat, because we can grow our own freaking wheat here. So I think that also, like, makes it, like, extra double surprising for a U.S. audience, the idea that, like, why would we be coming from an island nation when I could literally go out and I can see it outside my door? So I think that totally goes along with what you're saying, Lori.
And then you throw in just the, like,
the
general
climate change aspect to it as well.
And the racism of Western imperialisms, like, yeah, of course we're not paying attention to what's happening over there. You know, over there is where they are. We don't need to know about they. I think it all comes down to, like, the trying to profit off of other people. And then we see that in Fedra, and we even see that with, like, Joel. Like, he's been reduced to he's a smuggler because he has no other role because he refused to adapt. And so he's part of this new violent, brutal barter economy, getting drugs to people so that they don't have to feel anything.
Yeah. Well, and that,
I think it's a good thesis. I like it.
Well, and that, you know, if we say that, okay, this is kind of capitalism, and so it's, like, eating us, and, like, what happens when it's collapsed is they basically have to go back to the beginning, to a hunter-gatherer society, right? Like, there's no currency,
yes.
Right? Like, it's straight.
Yeah, then that's why I like all the zombie
back,
shows.
All the way back
right.
To hunter-gatherers.
Yep, you got to find out what's real. You have to have real relationships with people, with your locality, as Lori was talking about. Like, you can't just go and get strawberries from Chile, you know. You've got to grow your own stuff, and it changes everything, you know.
Well, and we see that idea of, like, okay, and the people who, I guess, are prepared for it, like we see in a later episode, I think it's episode 4 with Bill and Frank, that the Nick Offerman character is ready. Like, he's like, no, it's coming, he's ready. And that he actually, like, they keep eating beef and strawberries and all sorts of things because that's the connection that he was already doing. And then that's the thing he's able to continue. And that you definitely see, I think you can also see it with, where, Tommy is out west, right? That, like, you can see kind of the amps. And the other thing is that this is very specifically that you get with zombie movies, it's a trope. they don't want anybody else. They don't want the dog. They don't want the cat. They don't want your parrot. They're not going to do anything with the chickens. They only feed on people. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the beauty of the zombie as a metaphor is cordyceps would happily take whatever they can get because mushrooms don't have the consciousness the same way that we do.
Right.
So for a zombie, it doesn't make much. It would be pretty cool if we had like a zombie cow coming at you. I think that would be fun to play in a video game, but it doesn't mean anything the way that Daryl Grandma biting your face off does. And with Bill and Frank, that is that was just such a perfect episode of television. I love that because Bill thinks he's ready, thinks he's prepared his entire life for this. He's a prepper. He's crazy.
He's got all of his guns.
Yeah. He is ready for the end of the world, and it is happening just the way he thought. And now he's alone, and he thought that was going to be fine too until this man shows up and changes his world entirely, and he realizes that he wasn't prepared, and what he was doing was hiding himself off from the things that are most important, and those things that are most important are the human connections that Frank represents. And it's gorgeous. That whole episode is just perfection.
Well, and that is one of the ones that like the show creators took a much more like obvious stance in the game. It seems more like they're kind of like really annoyed, pissed off neighbors with each other that like they live nearby, but they never really get along. They kind of hate like, and so the show creators are like, you know what, we're going to do something very like, we're going to take this place that people who are used to the game have been to or know about, like, they're going to see it, but it's going to be very, very different. And I think that's really interesting how they interpreted it.
Sarah, have you played the whole game?
I have not played the game. That's one of those, I'm not very good with zombies or scary things. My husband loves zombie movies and is always trying to get me to watch more. And in fact, I'll give you all this quick thing. So Night of the Living Dead, the first zombie movie. He had been wanting me to watch it for a while, and I hadn't wanted to watch it. And then he was playing a video game one day at night, and I was like, hey, let's watch this other movie. You've been wanting me to watch it. And he's like, well, I'm kind of in the middle of this game. I'll be done in like 30 minutes. And I was like, okay. And I thought, I was like, this movie's just in black and white. There's no way it's going to be that scary. I'm just going to put it on. And after like 15 minutes, I went in, I'm like, I'm scared. I'm so scared. And so I had to like pause it until he was done with the playing.
Okay, did you forget that Psycho, for instance, was in black and white? Did you forget that?
I know. Well, the thing, I don't know. I think I'm braver than I really am sometimes. So this I think is a good segue into the second big question I wanted to ask y'all, which is, in every zombie movie, or in every good zombie movie, it demonstrates that the scariest part of any zombie outbreak is always the other people. That the thing that's going to harm you most is probably another human, and what they're going to do to you and how they're going to repress you. We get this again 28 days late, 28 days when, again, the scariest part of that is like the military guys, who are like, oh, we're just going to take you and make a harem, and we're going to rebuild society, and you're going to be our forced wives. And there's like, what? Yep. And like, that is always to me, and that's the scariest part about that, which is different than when my husband watches it. He thinks a different part of it is the scariest. But as a woman, the part of like, oh no, you're gonna be forced into sexual servitude, like, to me, that's the scariest part of that movie, and it's different than what my husband thinks is the scariest. Do we think that the first episode of The Last of Us delivers on this concept?
Oh, yeah. For me, the absolute scariest are the jackbooted thugs, like the Fedra people, because I think the episode even suggests that, because really the first time we see the infected as mushroom infected, you know, like moving beyond the 2003, what is going on zombie stuff, it's a a body that has been cemented to a wall through the outgrowths of the fungus. And so we see Tess get startled by it, and Joel kind of makes fun of her a little bit for being scared by an obviously dead mushroom zombie, and she covers like, he just wasn't here last time, I wasn't expecting it. And so you kind of have the threat of the zombie cut, like the knees cut out from under it, but the threat of I'm a dude with a gun, that remains. That's universal.
Yeah. Not to mention the fact that the first character that we're led to identify with gets killed by a human being.
Yep.
Who, in a totally useless situation, right? No need whatsoever. They're, you know. And so, yeah, this is definitely about other people being the enemy.
Yeah, it's less about what happens when a mushroom takes over your brain than it is when civilization
breaks down.
Yeah. When the civil stops.
And we see that in the Kansas City episode, right? Or Kansas City episodes.
Yes.
That there's a lot that people will do for the understanding and the presumption of power and safety.
Yes. And to do a Foucauldian reading, not that I'm, you know, but, you know, I am leaving academia, so I need to bring up Foucault one time. It's like those violences in a civil society are just hidden, right? That the people who are actually in power are in power because of violent control, like, you know, but that's hidden usually in a civil society, right? You don't really think about the fact that you can't do whatever you want because somebody is going to actually physically throw you in jail. But
yeah,
in this world, you bet, you know?
Yeah, it's the niceties that we call civilization are stripped away, and
correct.
What you are left with is, I don't know, in a lot of ways, just pure id. And I think it's telling that the characters that we like the most are the ones who try and recreate some of those niceties. Maybe it's more telling of me in that I would just love to live
That's
in Rutina Wesley's world in Wyoming.
Yeah.
No, I think that would be good. And I think one of the things that when we talk about, like, who is the greatest, who is the scariest thing in a zombie movie is humans. And Joel is one of the humans to be scared of.
Oh, yeah. The double-crossing little rat dude that Tess tries to shut up, like, she does it by having Joel as the lurking monster in the background, like Frankenstein's monster. He is the threat, and he just stands there and he scares people.
Well, and especially if we jump all the way to the last episode where Joel takes out an entire hospital to save Ellie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of those things. Apparently, I think that the game designers they had a very different reaction to that than they thought. That any gamers who played the video game who were like, oh, some of them were like, about if they did not have children, about 50-50 split of like, should you have saved her? Oh, I don't know, it could have saved the whole world, I don't know. Like, it was about a 50-50 split. Any player who had a child was like, no, Joel was completely justified.
Yep.
100% justified. And so, especially in how they present it, like, it's very much like, well, we're just going to do exploratory surgery to see if maybe there might possibly be, like, you know, I feel like if they had really wanted to drive home that, like, what he was doing, that they should have had more of, like, no, by doing this and we can remove the parasite in her brain, we know 100, like, they should really have given it more heft. Because in me, I'm like, no, y'all are just murdering a little girl for, like, maybe, possibly.
We needed to spend some more time with the fireflies in order for that to land as a gut punch and not just as a weird,
like, why are they murdering this girl? You know, why did, man, Marlene sucks. Why did she send her to kill? You know, like, which is very much more my take on it, having, you know, with having two children. But I know that that's a big one. Well, Anything else, or should I move on to my final question, which is the most important question of any zombie discussion?
I have a story for this next question, so I'm ready.
So, listeners, go for it. The most important question of actually any zombie discussion is, are you ready for the zombie apocalypse? And so, if not, if so, what is your plan? Who is in your crew? Because this is, in my household, because my husband loves zombies, kind of a perennial, like, road trip question. Because as you're in different places and in different points in your life, you have to make, like, we had to update our plans because we had kids, right? Like, so instead of us both being out doing stuff, well, I'm going to be home with the kids. And so what is y'all's plan for the zombie apocalypse, and who is in your crew?
Oh, I love this question so much. And my first answer is, Sarah, I'm moving to Texas. That's my first answer. And the second one is, I have this neighbor.
We'll take you shooting and get you some guns.
Yeah, look, I went to gun camp. I went to gun camp this last summer, so I know how to shoot. My husband, we disagree on owning firearms, but I do know how to operate them. He wants to own them. I don't. But I know exactly who I would find. And in this current scenario, we used to have a neighbor he's a fireman. He doesn't live there anymore. He Airbnbs his house. But I'm like, I'm finding Matt, and I'm going to go wherever he is. You know, so it's like the people who know to do, you know, those are the people you go with.
So for me, the perennial thought project was actually something that my group of friends from grad school, we've spent a lot of time talking about this. Unless zombies, we have spent a lot of time talking about how we would deal with a zombie outbreak on UGA's campus. But more of, well, the civilization has collapsed. How are we going to deal with it? And our solution is Apocalypse Farms. We have done some math on how many livestock animals and of what type we would need, what orchards we should be planting. We each have our own assigned jobs. I am in charge of fermentation.
My nerding is just going out the window. I just love this.
So it's an excuse for you to become a homesteader, is what I'm hearing, Lori.
Yes. One of our friends has volunteered graciously to be a barter whore for us because she doesn't grow things. But we have one of our friends was actually a farmer before grad school, and she and her husband now make knives. They make craft artisanal blades, and there's a year-long waiting list for them. We have one friend who was originally from Detroit and now lives in Indiana, who'd come down, and he's gotten rid of some of his arsenal now that he's got children, but he's in charge of our armory. We have done the math on what cash crops we would have to grow. And yes, that does include a lot of marijuana. We have planned out.
I'm going to find you. I'm going to make my way to Georgia.
Oh, there was a spreadsheet that.
Good Lord, this is great.
Well, we were all in grad school during the Great Recession. And we're English graduate
that makes
students.
Sense.
Like, what are we going to do with our lives?
There's nothing else we're good for.
Right?
Yeah, totally.
So we started thinking about the things that we do have, you know, soft skills. And one friend was like, well, my uncle's got some property in Tennessee. And so we started planning it, and it got more and more in depth. And Apocalypse Farms is now almost 20 years running in our brains.
Well, I am very impressed with that. I originally, when my husband and I met, we were and I was still working as a librarian. We were going to basically set up camp on the campus of McLennan Community College, because we're like, it actually already has a lot of existing infrastructure we would need. Like, it has its own generator and power plant and the kitchen and
Colleges are great fortresses.
So I thought that would be good. Now we'll, I think our eventual plan will be, you know, land some house, you know, and like, we're never going to be able to be actually very good homesteaders. We're going to be like, oh, look at the picture of my baby ducks. And like, that's kind of it. but that we kind of know who we want to, we want people of different types in there. So like, okay, we need a nurse or a doctor in our crew. We need, we have some friends who are engineers, so we're going to want them in our crew. Because somebody's got to build the water wheels and bridges. So, you know, we kind of had some of those discussions. He's very firm that he's like actually no military, ex-military. And when I asked why, he's like, because they always think they're in charge in every situation. which I thought was pretty funny, considering he also is presuming he's going to be the one in charge. So, but yeah,
because he'll take charge.
Question. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess now I will be taking care of small babies. So I guess we'll be gardening and doing that kind of thing. So, all right.
Y'all can come join our autonomous collective.
I'm really excited about that. My friends around here are like, I'm just going to succumb. I'll be the first to go. So bye.
See, that is the hardiness of Southerners who are like, no, we shall overcome. You know, us Southerners, we're very used to Yankee incursions and having to make the best of it. So,
yeah, I regularly daydream about just chucking it all and becoming a professional farmer, like not like an industrial farmer, but you know, so when my family takes, this is a swerve.
Beautiful farmland.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And so my family, we go every year, we go to a beach in Florida and we drive down there and I pass all of these like small family farms and I see the soybeans and stuff that they plant. I'm like, why don't you have a garden? Why don't you have a subsistence garden? You people need a wider variety. You don't have grocery stores. Where are your tomatoes coming from?
Awesome.
So that's in the back of my mind always is like, you need, where am I going to get my chilies? I need to grow them. And if I just left academia entirely, I could grow plants. And being a dilettante, I'm also dabbling. I collect hobbies. Like that is my hobby, is to collect hobbies. So I'm slowly preparing myself to be a one person autonomous collective of the apocalypse.
Oh, that sounds like an excellent plan.
I'm
going to
find you, so you won't be a one person. I'll be there.
Thanks.
Hey, Lori, I'm coming over.
maybe if we can get to the zombie apocalypse at that point, my child will finally be potty trained. She's been going pee-pee fine in the toilet, but we pooped on the carpet.
It won't matter then, will it?
I won't care.
You won't care.
Yeah. Fine. All right, well, let's go on for our recommendations. I will go first, and my recommendation is the original 1968, Night of the Living Dead. It has all of, if you want to appreciate something, I think it's important to see, this is the first, and arguably, you know, best. And I say that because one of the things that makes zombie movies as a subgenre of horror great is that it's so effective for low budget new filmmakers. And so you can get a lot of amazing creativity with low budget stuff. And it really shows that with a great story and compelling characters that you can make something that's really, really outstanding. Even if we look at it and you're like, oh, it's not really gory in any traditional sense that we think of now. So I would say Night of the Living Dead.
That's fabulous. I love that.
That is fabulous. It's so good because, you know, it proves that even old things, like things that were born in 1968, can still have value.
Is there specific about the board being born in 1968?
Yeah, I was born in 1968.
what about you, Christina?
Okay, well, I am teaching a graphic novels class right now, and one lecture I let out saying something like, back when The Walking Dead was good, and the students all laughed, and I loved the first two seasons of the TV show because of all the things that we were talking about, the attention to detail, the real sensibility of the space, like the visuals of it was more like the graphic novel that it came from. And it did so many things that were similar to the beginning of Last of Us, where you follow Rick and he's looking for his family, and you think the whole show is going to be about finding his family, but he finds them immediately. And so it's always kind of playing with your expectations, and it's full of surprises and different communities that they meet. And I just really love the first two seasons.
All right. What about you, Lori?
I've got a recommendation for you specifically, Sarah.
Yes.
It is a sort of zombie movie that I think you might actually dig. It's a Val Lewton produced piece called I Walked with a Zombie, and it's like Haitian zombies in it, but it's a romance. It's a horror in the way that movies from the 30s were horror, but I think you dig it. And my recommendation for everyone is another Craig Mazin HBO show, but it's like the real world version of all of the capitalism and power and authority issues that in The Last of Us, and it's Chernobyl. I strongly recommend watching Chernobyl on a beautiful day with like surrounded by puppies and kittens and maybe also babies laughing, because it is hard. It is hard to watch.
That's a rough show to watch. I wasn't able to finish it when we were going through it the first time because it was too much for me. I couldn't take it.
The show sticks the landing. I will say that. And Jesse something or other, she was in Alex Garland's Men. She's fabulous as the sort of everyday protagonist in it. But I recommend it. And before we go, I also want to recommend that people listen to our Mythic Quest episode, because Craig Mazin plays the creepazoid game tester, and in the cold open of the pilot, Josh Brenner, the host of the late night TV show for Last of Us, he plays the young version of CW. So there's synergy there. Listen to all our episodes.
I didn't even notice that. Yeah,
it's the power of autism. You pick up on these patterns.
I love it.
All right. Well, thank you for listening, everyone, to the Christian Feminist Podcast. We'd love to hear from you. If you have a topic or reading recommendation for future shows, or you just want to drop us a line, you can do so at ChristianFeministPodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on our Facebook page or at the network's Twitter handle, CH Radio Network. And check out the show notes from this and other episodes at the Christian Humanist blog at ChristianHumanist.org. The Christian Feminist Podcast is a member of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Kristen Filippik is our press liaison. For Lori Norris and Christina Bieber-Legge, I'm Sarah Kluster. Tune in next time for a discussion of the film Journey to Bethlehem. Until then, in essentials unity, in non-essentials liberty, and in all things love.
All right.
Yay!
Yay, we did it. So how have I known you all these years, and you're on the spectrum?
I am.